Okay, today I'm going to go into an overview of regenerative medicine. There's enough going on these days that it gets kind of confusing in terms of the terminology and what different technique does which and which is better. And although we still don't have a lot of answers on the which is better question, hopefully I can clear the air on what the different options are and what the different terminologies are. So there are two main categories of tools that we can use in regenerative medicine. One category is components that we can get from peripheral blood. And under that umbrella, we have platelet-rich plasma, autologous conditioned plasma, and autologous conditioned serum. The autologous conditioned serum is more of an equine product. I'll touch upon it here, but it's the PRP and the ACP that matter more to us with dogs and cats. The other component is stem cells. So there are mesenchymal stem cells, and that isn't a term. It's commonly used to describe stromal vascular fraction or bone marrow aspirate, but technically it's something different, and in the interest of avoiding slang, we should probably be a bit more careful about what we're actually describing when we talk about different treatment options. So I'm going to start with the cellular component first, and again, this should probably not be anything surprising to any of you guys, but it's still worth clarifying. When we talk about stem cells, we're not talking about embryonic stem cells. Embryonic stem cells come attached to a lot of political baggage, which makes it hard to use, and frankly, they're finding that they're not as useful. They have too much potential, basically. So, you know, you start trying to inject stem cells into an area of damaged heart and end up growing a full set of teeth instead, that's awkward. Whereas what we're talking about are mesenchymal stem cells, the stem cells that we all have in our bodies, more so in young dogs or people than older ones, but they're multipotent stromal cells that can differentiate into osteoblasts, chondrocytes, myocytes, adipocytes, so that, you know, make bone, cartilage, tendon, muscle, adipose tissue. They can also become neural cells, cardiomyocytes, and pneumocytes, which affects us less in the sports medicine side. As a side note, that has nothing to do with the lecture. I have a client who works in a lab where they have a 3D printer, which they load up with stem cells and are producing small organs. So their record so far is they've made a trachea, or a large bronchial that's about 7 inches long and 1.5 inches high, and they use it to test bronchodilating drugs on because they can make this thing contract or expand. They're far away off from being able to 3D laser or 3D print actual usable organs, but that's where they're headed for. So there's some crazy science fiction stuff going on out there. That is also a client who knows more about inflammatory mediators than I will ever know. Anyway, so talk about mesenchymal stem cells. When we talk about that, we should be talking about a pure colony of stem cells without other components. So usually we're talking about a cultured stem cell where they've taken macerated fat typically and extracted the stem cells out of it and then extend them through several generations and blown it out to a large enough number for therapeutic use. If they're cells that have come from the patient, then they're autologous. However, the other thing that's being developed are allogenic stem cells. So these are stem cells that could be pulled from one dog and put into any dog. And this is one of the neat things about stem cells is they have these MHC2 receptors on them, which I compare to a Harry Potter invisibility cloak, because when you have these receptors on you, then the host immune system doesn't recognize you. So these stem cells can be universal donor cells that can go into anyone. And that's kind of neat because as that develops, you know, we're potentially down the road looking at just buying a bottle of stem cells from your veterinary supply company, keeping it in the fridge, and then putting it in once it's needed. and this may also be cheaper than our existing options. So having described mesenchymal stem cells, I want to distinguish that between a bone marrow aspirate or a stromal vascular fraction. A stromal vascular fraction is what many people are most familiar with on the veterinary side. So it's a lipoaspirate that, you know, basically a collection of adipose tissue that's been macerated, and it does contain a large population of stem cells called adipose-derived stem cells, or ADSCs, but also has T regulatory cells, endothelial precursor cells, pre-adipocytes, macrophages, and components like that that appear to help with the healing process. Pound for pound, fat yields more stem cells than bone marrow aspirate does, and it may be that fat-derived stem cells are easier to expand and cryopreserve. There are desktop systems for macerating the fat and extracting the stem cells. I haven't seen any third-party independent research comparing different systems and looking at the effectiveness of these systems. Your other option, there are send-out labs where you can just collect the fat, send it out, they will process it, send it back to you a day or so later, and then you can inject the stromal vascular fraction into your patient. The most common indication for this is as an arthritis treatment. It should be noted, though, that research has shown that 24 hours shipping is enough to sort of decrease the strength of these stem cells or the effectiveness of them. So bone marrow aspirate is basically what it sounds like. It's very similar to stromal vascular fraction, except instead of deriving it from macerated adipocytes, it's just an aspirate that you drew straight from the bone marrow. And bone marrow, of course, is high in stem cells, which is part of the reason why broken bones are so good at healing. So what do stem cells or stromal vascular fraction, bone marrow aspirate do? So they're cells that are activated with naturally occurring trauma. Aging and disease doesn't really activate them. And they have several functions, predominantly tissue regeneration, anti-inflammatory functions, reduction of scar formation. Their action is through secreting growth factors, cytokines, chemokines. They have systemic immune system effects, where then you get into the use of stem cells in treating IBD or other immune-mediated conditions like that. It's worth noting that you get heterogeneous yields between patients. So you can take the same dog and pull fat from one area and fat from a different area, and you may not get the same yield with each one. Or, you know, you pull a bone marrow with any of them, you pull bone marrow out of the tibia or the iliac wing or the humerus or the femur, and it depends. You get different yield on different bones, and, you know, you might get differences left versus right. And so we're still working out best places to collect the stem cells. For adipose-derived, you get per unit weight greater yield from sub-Q fat versus falciform ligament. I still can't bring myself to collect sub-Q fat. Most of the time I don't get an option because I'm dealing with competition dogs that don't have any sub-Q fat. But, you know, the problem with collecting from the axilla is you can get into seromas, and patients or owners hate Penrose grains, and I haven't had a problem with, by and large, with getting it from the falciform ligament. I did have one case where the falciform ligament cells didn't culture well, but it didn't seem to be a problem of the initial yield, and we still don't know why that happened. But it's biology. Sometimes stuff like that does happen. So although stem cells themselves can be involved in healing, they have a lot of paracrine effects. So a lot of what they do is they recruit the local cells to contribute to the regeneration process. Again, as I mentioned earlier, older dogs, the stem cells are less active. So indications, again, the most common one is as an osteoarthritis treatment where you can get about 11 months duration out of them on average. As we talked about in another lecture, there's some utility in using them in cruciate ligament repair. Where I find they really shine is in tendon repair. So I'm using them quite frequently in iliopsoas injuries, supraspinatus, and we have the most data out there on supraspinatus. But I also use them for MSIs and partial bicep tears and get good return to function in high-end athletic dogs. And again, it's kind of nice. You can do an ultrasound, see grossly abnormal tissue. 2 months later, you put the ultrasound probe back on and you're looking at nice, healthy tendon. They definitely have a capacity to regrow tendon. We've been trying to get them to regrow cartilage, and you know, though it could be used for arthritis, the benefits are palliative. We were all hopeful initially that, you know, we were going to reverse arthritis. We can't do that yet. We have trouble making them form chondrocytes, but more importantly, we have trouble keeping them in cartilage defects. You know, they need a good scaffold to grow, and the toxic environment of an arthritic joint decreases stem cell viability by, I believe, 35%. But even if they try these fibrin plugs, it's real hard to keep them in cartilage defects, and we're just not there with growing new healthy cartilage in a in vivo arthritic joint. But another decade, and I'm sure someone will figure this stuff out. Okay, so now that we know we could have pure cultured mesenchymal stem cells, which could be either autologous or allogenic, or we could have stromal vascular fraction or bone marrow aspirate. You know, the big question is, okay, which one's the best one to use? And we don't know. Again, the research in dog shoulders, the non-published opinions that I've been hearing are that none of those different options, adipose versus bone marrow versus cultured, shines above the other. What clearly does make a difference is combining them with PRP versus using them in the absence of PRP. That seems to be an important thing. And again, PRP can help provide a scaffold for those stem cells. The research showing in vitro research anyways, I think you make a strong argument that bone marrow aspirate stem cells are superior for tendon repair. They penetrate the tendon better. They have a number of advantages. Whether or not that translates into long-term significance or clinically relevant difference, we don't know. There's some argument the bone marrow may be better for cartilage, but we're so far away from regrowing cartilage that stays where it's supposed to that that's probably not useful information. It's worth noting that multiple passage of stem cells, so you kind of, as you expand cultured cells, they go through a couple of passages, which increases the numbers, but the stem cells themselves become less effective. And as well, when you take stromal vascular fraction or BMA, you're dealing with sort of multiple lines of stem cells, whereas when you start to culture them, you're kind of replicating the same types of stem cells. And, you know, is that a factor? Is the fact that cultured cells individually don't seem to be as strong a factor? They found that greater than two passages of stem cells when used in treating human leukemia, that they start to see a drop in effectiveness. The thing is, you get much better numbers with cultured cells. You know, if you're taking stromal vascular fraction or BMA, and, you know, maybe you get, say, somewhere between 30,000 to 70,000 cells, which is great, but if you go out and culture them, now you've got 10 million. And, you know, if you've got 10 million soldiers, maybe they're not as good at hand-to-hand combat as some of the other stronger soldiers, but 10 million versus 30,000, does that more than compensate? And, you know, do we need 10 million? Is 5 million? Is 1 million? You know, what is the optimal dose? And we have no idea. There was one study that found allogenic cells outperformed adipose to stromal vascular fraction, but again, I wouldn't hang our hat on one study. Another study that looked at the fact that joint fluid is toxic to stem cells found that you need to do a lavage with 60 times the joint fluid volume, and then that really takes out that effect. So whenever possible with arthritic joints, I like to lavage them out. That's fine if we're doing treatment after surgery. If we're just going in for in a geriatric dog to inject those elbows, then it becomes a bit more of a procedure, and so I'm not routinely doing that because that's a fairly large volume to flush through a joint. Okay, so our second category is things that we find in the blood. So there's autologous conditioned serum versus autologous conditioned plasma, or ACS versus ACP, and ACP, we'll just use that interchangeably with PRP. So the first people might recognize autologous conditioned serum by the term IRAP, and IRAP itself isn't used in dogs. I'm not sure where the problem is, but Arthrex says, yeah, no, we don't use it in dogs, and I'm sure if Arthrex could sell IRAP kits to small animal veterinarians, they would. So there must be some significant reason why it doesn't work as well in dogs. IRAP stands for interleukin-1 receptor antagonist. So interleukin-1 is a major inflammatory mediator. And you can get monocytes, you can trigger them to increase their production of an antagonist interleukin-1, so it has a net anti-inflammatory process, and what that looks like is you pull a bunch of blood, expose it to chromium sulfate treated glass beads, incubate it for 24 hours, produces a number of anti-inflammatories, interleukin-10, which is anti-inflammatory, but you take this IRAP and then re-inject it into the joints, and it's been found in horses to help with arthritic pain, synovitis, things like that. So on the dog side, we're using more PRP or ACP, and what we're doing is triggering growth factors, cytokines, chemokines. The way I explain it to clients is that platelets are the frontline soldiers for wound repair. They come in, they stop the bleeding. Once they do that, they release these alpha granules that transition you out of the inflammatory phase and into the reparative phase of healing. So they're just inherently anti-inflammatory and anabolic. They trigger chemotaxis of other cells like macrophages, fibroblasts, etc. They trigger angiogenesis. They release a ton of growth factors, platelet-derived growth factor, IGF-1, IGF-2, TGF-beta, VEGF, fibroblastic growth factor, osteocalcin, osteonectin, fibronectin, thrombospondin 1, just a bunch of things that help with healing. You can activate them with calcium and turn them into a gel, or you can do it as a straight liquid. Again, the gels are what they've been trying to use to plug cartilage defects and having limited success with. So commonly used for treatment for osteoarthritis, for tendon repair, for wound repair. In contrast to the stem cells, I tell clients that for any articular injection, whether it's hyaluronic acid with corticosteroids, PRP, stem cells, I sort of tell them to expect that 4 out of 5 dogs are going to respond. If we're doing stem cells, then I'm telling them that we're looking for 11 months of response. If we're doing PRP, then we're looking for about 9 months response. So PRP tends to be my first line as an arthritic treatment versus stem cells. Similar to stem cells, we're still trying to figure out appropriate dosages. The amount of activation seems to be a factor and possibly one of the reasons we're getting variable results. To be considered a PRP, we need at least a threefold increase of platelets relative to the peripheral blood. We're ideally looking for 5 to 7. And again, it's sort of a bell curve, Goldilocks zone, because you get up to 10 times, then you start to see pro-inflammatory responses. So, which is better, PRP or, you know, some sort of stem cell, SVF, or BMA product? Again, if we're looking at healing tissue, tendon, ligament, then it really looks like there's a symbiosis that the platelets really trigger a bigger response out of your stem cells. So anytime I'm doing stem cells, I'm combining it with PRP. However, for a straight arthritis treatment where we're not necessarily striving to grow new tissue, you can make an argument that PRP is outperforming stem cells. 6 out of 6 papers that looked at PRP for intra-articular use that were random controlled trials, 6 out of 6 papers showed a positive benefit. 2 out of 3 of the papers that compared stem cells to PRP showed that PRP were better. I haven't seen any papers, again, that looked at combining them versus having them individually. And we don't have as much data on stem cells with, you know, with controls and objective gait measures. So you could argue that, again, the research on PRP is greater than that for stem cells. Add to the fact that PRP is cheaper. We generally, you know, if we're in for stem cells, we're guaranteed that we're doing a general anesthetic. But with PRP, we're just pulling blood. You know, especially since we're doing this a lot in geriatrics. If we're going to the hip, yeah, because I can't do it without ultrasound guidance, so we're always sedating for that. But on a good dog using the medial approach, fine, we can get in the elbow, sometimes with nothing on board, or maybe a little bit of torb just to take the edge off of them. You know, some of the, you know, I do knees with just local and a bit of torb, shoulders as well. I'm not doing that as much in geriatrics, so I'm tend to dropping them under Domator for that. Often with shoulders, I'm injecting multiple structures, so we're deepening the anesthetic for that. But especially for the elbows, if we can get there with next to no anesthetic, that's very palatable for the geriatric. So I think that's a strong argument for PRP over stem cells. There are a number of commercial PRP kits out there, and discussing which kit to go with is, yeah, that's a whole lecture unto itself. The one place with joints where I will look at stem cells is we've got some good indicators that stem cells work with neuropathic pain. So if I'm dealing with an arthritis case where the pain just seems disproportionate to the disease, and I'm wondering if we're having some sort of neural dysfunction as part of that, then I'll go to stem cells in hopes that I'm addressing that as well. Again, this is all theoretical. I have no hard data to back that up. But I remember one of my earliest stem cell cases was for an iliopsoas dog, and this was a dog that if you took him to the base of a ramp or a set of stairs, would sit there and cry. He's a delicate flower. And all 40-something kilograms of him, and the owner would have to carry this dog upstairs because it just the thought of that little amount of hip extension was just too much. And so we ultrasounded, found that, yeah, we've got some tearing of the iliopsoas, so we injected it with stem cells. And a couple of weeks later, we've got the owner calling to say they're having trouble with postoperative exercise restriction because the dog keeps jumping over the back of the furniture. And the timeline on that was so short, I knew for sure we weren't dealing with healed tendon, but the profound reduction in pain to me suggested that there was a neuropathic component and that the stem cells had addressed that, and that's why we got such a dramatic clinical response so quickly. So just briefly mention combining stem cells with other modalities. The information that's come out, there's been some papers again in 2016 that show that giving laser enhances stem cells, increases their viability, stimulates migration and collagen production. It doesn't seem to be as much a factor of the wavelength that they choose. It's more about dosing. But one facility argues you doing 5 joules every 3 to 7 days for the first 8 weeks post-implant. There have been some unpublished concerns. Is a class 4 laser too powerful? There are people with the opinion that 3B or lower laser and not going to class 4. I don't know if anyone's ever resolved that issue and shown that class 4 is safe or not, but as it is, I don't have a class 4, I've just got a 3B, so it doesn't affect me, so I haven't worried about it too much. We also have some equine research that shows that using shockwave immediately after injecting with PRP gives you better activation and, in theory, better results. Because again, like I mentioned earlier, incomplete activation may be one of the reasons that we get some of these dogs that don't fully respond. So that's something to consider after doing PRP injections. All right, well, hopefully that helped clear some of the mud out of the water and you have a bit better understanding of the different terms that are out there and the different indications and where we stand at this point with the use of regenerative medicine for musculoskeletal issues.